A very warm welcome to this episode of Geburtsgeschichten podcast. Geburtsgeschichten is German and means birth stories. And this podcast is usually held in German, but once in a while I have an English speaking guest on. And one of them is my guest today, Hermin Hayes Klein. Hermin is an American attorney and advocate for reproductive justice and human rights in pregnancy and childbirth. I first became aware of Hermin and her work about 2.5 years ago when I was pregnant myself with my second and I had planned a home birth after a previous cesarean. But when I was 20 weeks pregnant, my home birth midwife that I had hired for my birth was accused by the state of Austria of causing harm to a newborn baby by gross negligence. And she has since been found guilty of causing the death of that baby. She has appealed the decision and the appeal judges have ruled that the first trial wasn't proper and there is a retrial coming up. So we don't have a ruling on that case yet. But ever since then, I'm really passionate about the rights of pregnant women, where and with whom they choose to birth, and also the rights of midwives. And that's how I came to this conversation with Hermin Hayes Klein, and we talk all things human rights, bodily autonomy in childbirth, and what both pregnant women and their partners, but also midwives and doulas, can do to protect their rights. The case of my midwife that I've mentioned, I've gathered some information about that case and I put the link to that in the show notes. And there's also a link for a crowdfunding campaign because that midwife, her name is Margarete Wanner, has to pay all her legal costs out of pocket. And that is a lot of money. So if you want to support a home birth midwife in her fight for justice, then please donate if you can. Thank you very much. And now I hand over to Hermin Hayes Klein.
Geburtsgeschichten. Ich bin Thea Maillard. In diesem Podcast erzählen Frauen von ihrer Schwangerschaft, der Geburt und dem Wochenbett.
Hello and a very warm welcome to you, Hermin. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast today. Could you introduce yourself to my listeners, please?
Oh, yes. Good morning. It's my pleasure to join you, Thea, on your podcast today. My name is Hermin Hayes Klein. I'm an American attorney. I live in Portland, Oregon, USA. And my work as a lawyer relates to women's fundamental rights in pregnancy and childbirth. I started this work while I was living in the Netherlands, teaching law in The Hague. So I still consult and do this work internationally and around the United States. And my work as a lawyer consists of sort of both defending community midwives and doulas and access to their care and choices, you know, reproductive choice in child pregnancy and childbirth, as well as issues of autonomy more directly by cases where I represent women who've been injured in childbirth in contexts where their rights of informed consent were violated. I bring lawsuits against obstetricians and hospitals for their injuries. That's my work.
Wow. Yeah, we'll get into that shortly. But first of all, I would like to know what you know about your own birth.
Yes. Well, what I know about how I was born is that I was born in the United States in 1974. In Massachusetts, in the hospital. And my mother was always told me how she did the Lamaze method and had an unmedicated childbirth using breathing. And how, you know, I think she was quite proud of herself. And as so often happens when you hear about, you know, unmedicated births or more physiologic births, there was the story of like, and everybody came to watch and they couldn't believe that wasn't taking the drugs kind of thing. And I guess what one of the things I find interesting, or once I became a mother myself and I learned more about birth I went back to my mother and I said, did you let them take me away from you after I was born? And she said, yeah, you know, they took you to the nursery. And I said, well, why did you let them do that? Like, it's not good for a baby mammal to be taken away from their mother. And she's like, well, you know what you know at the time, you know, and what I knew at the time was that I wanted to avoid the medications. That wasn't on my radar, you know, essentially to think about the impact on the baby of being taken away and put in a box down the hall.
Yeah, so interesting.
Yeah.
So let's get into your work. How did you become passionate about this kind of work?
Well, I think as I've always been interested in women's sexual and reproductive rights. I think the intersection of kind of private aspects of our lives with the law is really interesting because there are some ways that we need the law to protect private aspects of our lives, but at the same time, we also need privacy. And so this, when the state gets involved in really personal aspects of our lives, it's risky, one might say. So I've always found that interesting. And I guess one way I looked at it as a young woman was in university days, was looking at the phenomenon of sexual assault and the law, and looking at, I wrote, you know, why is the conviction rate so low? The American Department of Justice that said at the time, mid-90s, that 3% of rapes end up in convictions. So it was like, well, why does 97% of rapists get away with it? You know, so I started looking at that question. And then ultimately, fast forward, my friends started having babies before me. And one of them asked me to read Ina May's Guide to Childbirth with her, so we could talk about it. And I read that book and it blew my mind because I had never thought about birth. I had never read birth stories before. And Ina May's Guides to Child, she was this American midwife in the 1970s who sort of helped, was part of the movement that sort of rediscovered midwifery and rediscovered physiologic birth. And in her book, Ina May's Guide to Childbirth, that she published in 2000, that's where she explained what I've learned in 25 years as a midwife is that if a woman feels safe and loved, and basically if she's in conditions that facilitate the flow of oxytocin, the birth is going to go well most of the time. But that if she feels anxious or frightened or ashamed or anything that facilitates adrenaline, it's going to block oxytocin, and that can lead to complications. And that blew my mind because it's like, well, think of all the circumstances that women have birthed in over the centuries where they would feel anxious and ashamed or afraid, or what's going to happen to the baby after it's born. Or then it starts to be like, well, no wonder some women have been dying in childbirth so long. You know what I mean? And understanding that how much about childbirth is psychological and emotional, and how much that the woman's actual interior experience matters to how it's going to be going medically. And then I ended up giving birth to both of my babies at home in the Netherlands. I moved to Holland in 2007, pregnant with my first. Long story short, I found an amazing midwife and I gave birth at home in Holland to both of my babies with her in 2007 and 2010. And then around 2010, she got a complaint filed against her for supporting women with twins and breeches and VBACs. But the complaints were just for the twins and breeches. And that's when I realized, wow, I thought Holland really gave women a choice for where to birth their babies. But nope, even here, it's like you're allowed and you're not allowed. And it's like, wow, even here, everywhere seems to be confused about who's allowing who to do what when it comes to the bodies of birthing women, and that we really need some clarification about that issue. And then realizing no other lawyers are working on this issue, or very few. I mean, they're very rare. and yet, you know, so that it was kind of like a forgotten issue of feminism. Like, there's plenty of lawyers protecting our rights to abortion and contraception, although, you know, that work needs to be done. And in the United States, even those rights are insecure. But nobody's working on childbirth and what happens to our rights when we keep the baby. So that became my focus, in part just to protect my midwife to start. And then it just became my obsession.
Yeah, maybe just for context for the listeners who don't know, the Netherlands, they have a home birth rate of, I think at the moment, it's about 12%. It's also declining because it used to be about 20% not that long ago.
Oh, no, it used to be 80%. Like, for the home birth rate to have fallen to 12% in the Netherlands is an absolute tragedy and a product of you know, the globalization of maternal health care in the Netherlands. Like, I would hear about these OBs going to international conferences while I lived there and being like shamed by the horrible obstetricians from other countries for allowing all the women to do the things that they allow women to do over there. And oh my God, that's a, and then the media propaganda. Like, and that was another thing I learned there is like OBs have a big budget for media. Midwives have no budget for anything, let alone media. And so when you read articles about childbirth, when you read articles about OBs and midwives, those are propaganda. The media, all it really ever does is childbirth, with childbirth is propaganda.
Yes, I would like to hear about that a bit more. So when you had your first case supporting or defending your midwife, what did that change for you in your practice? And in a way, I think it has never let you go in a way, like you were still doing that same work. Like, what particular about that was so compelling that you couldn't turn away ever since?
Well, I mean, it's, I guess it's the combination of realizing that, you know, when they attack, like when I went and talked to the mothers, like when she told me she had a complaint against her, I said, well, I want to see if I can help you. Even though I don't speak Dutch, I'm going to have to help you find a Dutch lawyer that can actually represent you in this. But first, let's just try to understand the problem. And so I want to go and and talk to those mothers. And I did, and heard from the mothers how they had wanted a hospital birth, but they had been so bullied and pushed around and the right to informed consent violated that they fled and looked for somebody else who would support them respectfully. And that, in a way, that was when I first realized that, like, as the risk of giving birth in the hospital goes up, women are willing to accept a higher level of risk outside the hospital, and that being disrespected and abused is a real risk factor that women have to weigh in the balance when they're assessing their options in childbirth. And then realizing that when the law or the medical authorities that have the power to mobilize the law, when those people attack midwives, what they're really doing is trying to make sure that women have nowhere else to turn when they are abused in the hospital setting, and that they can treat you however they want, because they're going to treat you different if they know that you can walk out the door and not pay them and go somewhere else than if they know that they're your only choice and they can do whatever they want.
Yeah. So that complaint against your midwife, was that a criminal case against her brought by the government?
No, this is Holland. They're civilized. So of course they're not going to bring criminal charges against a provider unless they're doing something truly criminal, like murder. You know, like when they go down the list of patients and they put them all to permanent sleep in the elder home, that's criminal, you know. But when it's negligence, the only reason the United States would go after midwives for a stillbirth, you know, when they would never go after an obstetrician for a stillbirth. That's how the state, you know, I mean, criminally, or Lithuania would do that kind of thing, right?
Well, places Austria, that do not. Austria is doing it right now.
Ah, well, places that are not, where the less secure human rights are generally, the more likely you are to see criminal attacks on midwives. And also, of course, the more powerful the obstetricians are, and the more of a hold they have over the health system and the more influence they have with the law, the more likely you are to see that kind of thing happening. But of course, that's totally uncivilized, especially if they're licensed. If midwives are licensed in Austria, the only proceeding that should happen against a licensed healthcare professional for an allegation of negligence is a licensing proceeding or a lawsuit, right? So, and of course, the allegations against a midwife are, I've worked on many cases defending midwives now, and they're always basically failure to diagnose, failure to intervene, right? Which is an everyday medical malpractice call. It's like, you should have seen that she needed to go to the hospital. She should have gone to the hospital, and it's your fault she didn't. But at the end of the day, what they're saying there, if you were saying that to a doctor, and that doctors are sued on these kinds of claims every day, you should have seen that intervention was needed and you should have intervened and you didn't. That's a negligence claim. To attach criminal proceedings to that kind of a claim is insanity. So, of course, they try to, like, in criminal proceedings, they try to
puff it up by saying things like, she put her home birth dogma over the safety of the baby and she didn't care if the baby died, you know, like, and that's, again, we're back into propaganda world at that point and burn the witch world. So in Holland, which
basically,
is
basically, I mean, I was present at the case that is going on in Austria. And I mean, luckily, the midwife has appealed and there are hopeful signs that maybe, well, her conviction was overturned and now it's going for retrial. But literally, the state attorney was using these words that you just used, that there was like the midwife influenced the birthing mother with her dogma. And that's why the mother chose the home birth.
So, and it's what's so interesting about those kinds of allegations is they can help you to see fundamentally what's under attack is they're attacking her for the idea, for an idea, more than an action. They're attacking her for holding a flag to tell women, you have another choice. You don't have to go. And they're literally trying to put her in jail to silence her. Think about Agnes Gareb, right, in Hungary, with your neighbor, right? So that what this is showing you, your nation has a choice. Is it more like Poland or more like France? in criminally prosecuting the midwife, Austria is deciding it's more like Poland. You know, it's like, who are you? You know, who's your identity? But Agnes, when we think about Agnes Gareb in Hungary, one of the court, you know, she was locked up in her house on house arrest. And then when she was finally allowed to leave her house, she was forbidden to speak to a pregnant woman. Like that's, so again, it's like this idea that midwives are like a Pied Piper and they're going to tootle their little flute and all the women are going to follow them out of the town.
Yeah. And I mean, that was just for context for people who don't know the name Agnes Gareb. That was like a case within the last 10 years, I think. Like fairly.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? The case was initiated. I mean, 2010 was the case of Tarnowski versus Hungary. That's when Agnes Gareb's client, Anna Tarnowski, went to the European Court of Human Rights and said, I want to have my second baby with my midwife, Agnes. I had it with her the first time, too. But she can't attend me because the status of midwives is so insecure here in Hungary that she could face criminal prosecution for attending me in my home birth. And the European Court of Human Rights said, that's wrong to criminally prosecute midwives. Women have a human right to choose where and with whom they have their babies and under the right to privacy. And the state violates that right if it fails to license and regulate midwives in a way that makes it clear that their services are acceptable, and then to regulate them in a way that respects the human rights of the birthing woman, which means you're not going to tell her she has to force the woman to the hospital. You're not going to tell her that she has to force anything or coerce or anything. That's what it would look like to respect that. And so that case of Tarnowski versus Hungary was then very important in protecting my Dutch midwife, right? So that case was a licensing proceeding before the Tucht Collegia, which is the Dutch licensing body. And it went before like an administrative hearing and they actually took her license after 25 years. And then we appealed it. And then the appeal licensing court gave her back her license, overturned the lower court's decision and said, no, you know, and something worth noting is that at the lower level, they were like, why are you talking about informed consent? This isn't about informed consent. This is about the duty of the midwife. I was like, no, the duty of the midwife is to follow informed consent, you know? And so finally, at the appellate level, they understood that. And they said, under Tarnowski versus Hungary, a woman has a right to choose where and with whom she has her baby, and we cannot attack midwives for supporting them in their choices. And they said, and in doing breach is within their scope, because it's vaginal physiologic breach and physiologic birth is within their scope. That was a good one.
That's amazing. So yeah, let's talk about the human right aspect of it. And let's talk about bodily autonomy.
Okay. So, you know, we have fundamental rights over our bodies that our nations, European nations, have agreed to acknowledge and respect and protect through a series of treaties. And two of the rights that are, or I'd say the three human rights that might be most relevant to navigating healthcare and pregnancy and childbirth are your right to autonomy, meaning you own this body. Nobody gets to do anything to it without your permission. Nobody gets to put it anywhere without your permission. You decide where it goes. You decide what happens to it. And if they want to do something to it, they have to tell you what they want to do, tell you about the risks and alternatives, and you decide whether anything is going to be done to your body, even when there's a baby in it. And then there's a right to privacy, which means you get to make your own personal reproductive and family decisions without state interference, without anybody else saying, no, you shouldn't make that decision about how many babies you're having or where and with whom you're having your babies, because I think you should make a different choice. No, you're violating my privacy. That's none of your business. You can do what you want with your family, and I'm going to do what I want with mine. That's privacy. And then number three is the right to freedom from discrimination, which is, you know, a right that everybody has. And yet in pregnancy, the violation of that right leads to bad things. So you could say sexism is a baseline that women face when they are pregnant and navigating system. And people are like, why are you talking? You should do what you're told. And then any layer of racism or, you know, prejudice that's piled on top of the sexism, studies show, make you more likely to die, more likely to see your baby die, and more likely to come out traumatized. So in the United States, that's racism, you know, against people who were historically enslaved. But around Europe and the world, it's racism, you know. So say African immigrants are going to have a terrible time probably in Austria giving birth. And Roma, you know what I mean? We have all those studies showing Roma women having worse outcomes. So we know that prejudice kills, actually, in pregnancy and childbirth. So those are your main rights. And so as far as your right to, like, you know, give birth vaginally after multiple cesareans or with a breech baby, that's your right to autonomy and your right to privacy. And the European Convention on Human Rights is a treaty that European nations have signed, including Austria. And the European Court of Human Rights hears cases from European citizens who believe that their European nation is violating one of their rights under that treaty, and that they have reached a dead end within their system where their state is not protecting their rights. That's what happened with Tarnovsky versus Hungary. Hungary was not protecting the right, so they had to go to the higher authority that then told Hungary what it had to do. Now, did Hungary follow through? Is it now regulating midwifery in a way that protects the rights of birthing women? Probably not. Like, maybe it's baby stepped a little bit further. But what has to be mentioned is that then the next year, Czech Republic has the same problem as Hungary, where its midwives are, you know, unlicensed, marginalized. And so then they brought another case to the European Court of Human Rights, like 2012, 13, saying under Tarnovsky, they have to follow Tarnovsky. So can you order them to do so? And that case, you know, unfortunately, was not as well brought as Tarnovsky. Tarnovsky was brought by a lawyer named Stefania Kapranci, and she did a really awesome job with that case. But Dubska, Czech Republic brought these ridiculous experts from the United States, expert OBs, who believe that women should not have rights, to get up there to say, women shouldn't have rights. And our job as doctors is to tell them what to do. And the Dubska lawyers didn't put on experts to adequately rebut that and prove that that's not the law, that's not bioethics, that's not nothing but those jerks' opinions. And in that case, the ECHR came back and said, well, we don't want to force nations. Sounds like the jury's out on whether home birth kills babies. So we don't want to force nations. So we'll let them kind of like make their own decisions about how to manage this, which, from a woman's rights perspective, it's an old story. Like, when our rights are violated historically, it's usually in some sort of narrative of like, well, we don't want to tell other men how to handle their women. You know what I mean? So we don't want to tell other nations, you know, internationally, nations will say, we don't want to tell that nation to stop abusing their women because it's their culture. And then within a nation, it's like, well, we don't want to tell that man to stop beating his wife because it's the family and he's the king of his castle, you know, like, so when women are sort of like kept in private and their rights are not, you know what I mean? And it's usually not good for women.
Yeah. I mean, I wish I would have known about you and your work and all these cases that have already been brought to the European Court of Human Rights 2.5 years ago, when I was in the situation that I was 20 weeks pregnant. I was discriminated because I had a scar on my uterus from a previous birth. And the very midwife that I had chosen for my birth, she's the one who then ended up in front of the court because a baby died after a transfer to hospital. So the baby didn't even die at home. The baby died in hospital. And the mother also had a previous cesarean. And the baby didn't die because of the home birth. The baby died because it had an undiagnosed in-uterine growth restriction that wasn't picked up in all the ultrasounds. And, I mean, as I said, the case is ongoing. So fingers crossed that she's found not guilty in the next round. But I just wish I had known that, because I know that I'm the kind of person who would have probably gone that far to the European Court of Human Rights.
Yes.
But I just didn't know. And that's why I think it's so valuable to speak to you, so that women know there is the opportunity, the possibility to actually do something when you're pregnant. Because I know that all over Austria, there are women at the moment who had previous cesareans who are desperately looking for home birth midwives, and they are rare because they're all scared.
It's bananas. And are they desperately looking for home birth midwives because in Austrian hospitals, they're going to be pushed, coerced, and bullied into a repeat cesarean?
Yeah. Or they might not just have the... I mean, I think there's some great hospitals with some great midwives in Austria, but I think it's a different experience.
Right. Well, yeah. You're less likely... I mean, is it the case in Austria, as in most places, that you're less likely to basically achieve physiology, you know, to sort of like have like a truly physiologic birth where you're just able to move and birth your baby? You have to leave the hospital for that. Is that right? Do they want you in a certain position in Austrian hospitals?
Say that again, please.
Do they want you like on your back on the bed?
No, luckily not. I think, I mean, compared to the US, I think we have some really great midwives. We have some really great hospitals. And also some great doctors. But then the thing is that we don't really have the culture here that you have your own obstetrician for a birth, unless you have private insurance and you pay for that. But it's basically, if you go to the hospital and you don't have a lot of money to pay for a private doctor and a private midwife, then you're just at the mercy of whoever's there. And I think that's the biggest concern for women, that they know there's this one VBAC supportive doctor, but if that doctor is not on call when the birth starts, then they don't know what to do.
Yes. I mean, that's very real. And again, like, if your rights were secure, if you knew you could rely on your rights to informed consent, because I'm sure you have a right to informed consent in Austria, and a right to make your own medical decisions. If you could rely on that right, it would not matter who's on call. Right. But because we cannot rely on our rights, because obstetricians are laboring under the illusion that they can do whatever they want to birthing women, it's dangerous. You know what I mean? That what that means is that you're subject to the whims of whoever's standing in front of you, because there might be, you know, there might be a permissive obstetrician that might allow your baby to come out of your vagina. And then you're like, oh, he decided to let my baby come out my vagina. I didn't decide. He decided to allow it. But she won't allow it, right? So what? Huh? Who's allowing who? You know?
Yeah.
Like, she won't allow me to not be cut open. What? What world are we in?
That's just crazy.
It is.
So what can women and birthing people, but also midwives, do to protect their rights?
Well, I mean, I think knowing your rights, right? So a lot of people just don't even know who gets to make the decisions here. And knowing, you know, I think something that you could do on this podcast would be to illuminate, like, what exactly are the Austrian laws on informed consent? What do they say? So, like, get an Austrian lawyer on here to explain that. Like, what are the sources? Is it in your constitution? Is it statutory? You know, what within your legal structure, what does that look like? But I guarantee you it's there. And it's protected by the European Court of Human Rights as well. Like, European Court of Human Rights would require Austria to pass laws that make sure they protect the right to informed consent. And the case to read on that, which is absolutely pertinent to VBAC, is Konovalova versus Russia. You can Google that. Konovalova. versus Russia. This woman brought her action because she was subjected to a birth that she described as torture. She sued under the right to freedom from torture, where the use of Pitocin and then morphine and Pitocin to turn it up, turn it down, turn it up, turn it down, all to teach students. And so she sued. And one of the things she sued under was the right to autonomy to not, she didn't consent to those students, and she won. And the court's discussion of the right to, of like the basis for women's rights to make their own decisions in pregnancy and childbirth in that opinion is very valuable. In case you don't know how like court opinions work, if you Google that case, you're going to find an opinion of what the court wrote. And it's going to describe from their perspective what happened. And you kind of have to read between the lines to understand why this woman sued for under freedom from torture. You know, like she was put through it. But then when you read their analysis for their decision, they'll discuss a whole lot of different treaties that all protect your rights. And that's every European nation, including yours. So understanding that, like, and then understanding the medicine. So like, in the case of VBAC, and of course, this is true for basically all decisions in childbirth, like there are five sets of relevant risks to any decision that a woman has to make in childbirth. The short-term risk to this baby she's carrying, the long-term risks to this baby she's carrying, short-term risks to her. How is she going to come out of this birth? Long-term risks to her. What's the long-term impact on her from this birth? And then her future pregnancies. All of those, there's statistics and medical facts that this decision, just between vaginal birth and cesarean, is relevant to. Whoever's bullying you, they're only looking at one of those five. And they're bullying you in the name of one of those five. You get to remind them that, yes, your baby matters. And trust me, your baby matters more to you than them. So let's start right there. All right. Start right there, y'all. Coming at me about my baby. Are you suggesting that you care more about this baby than I do, who has been growing it in my body for the last 9 months? So let's just get clear on who's looking out for this baby, okay? And now let's talk about, guess what else? Guess who else gets to matter? Your actual patient. Your actual patient. My baby is not your patient. I'm your patient. You work for me. And yes, you have to look out for my baby and tell me what I need to know so I can make decisions for my baby. But the fact that I'm carrying a baby does not mean that you have two patients in the sense that you get to force me in the name of my baby. You don't get to do that. I'll make the decisions for my baby. Okay? So you can tell me what I need to know. And guess what? What I'm hearing in my ears is that all you've talked about is the risk to my baby. But guess what? I educated myself. So I know that what you're trying to push me into is way riskier for me. And guess what? Also my future babies. Guess what? They matter too, doctor. Oh, they don't matter to you at all? Oh, and you know what? Turns out this baby doesn't matter to you at all either. Do they, doctor? You know what I mean? It's like, don't even get me started on this. So like, just come back at them with those five axes, you know, because, and of course, like, is that going to, can I promise you that's going to protect you? Like, no, there's this, you know, this case that's going around the media in the United States, or two cases out of Florida, where when a woman tried to stand up for her right to VBAC, the bullies at the hospital called a judge, lied to the judge, told the judge her body's going to explode and her baby's definitely going to die unless you let us cut her open, and got an order for permission to cut her open when they felt like it. And that woman was very well informed. She was very well informed on her rights, and she was very well informed on the medical evidence. So she understood the risks. She had three older children. She talked about the risk of orphaning those children. And this is a Black woman in a country where Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die in childbirth. Like, her risk of dying is not nothing. This is not an abstraction. And yet, they didn't care about the risk of her dying. They did not care at all. And they didn't consider it relevant. They didn't even mention it. So, and the judge, all they're looking at is the baby. So, you know, that's a, but when there's a bad case or a bad decision, does that mean you don't have rights? No. Think back to sexual violence, right? 3% of rapes end up in convictions. 97% get away with it. Does that mean you don't have a right to not get raped? No. You do have a right to not get raped, but the system is failing to protect that right. You know, it's kind of complicated legally, right? Because you could think, well, I guess I don't have a right if my right is not protected. Maybe I don't even have the right. No, you do have the right. And we have to keep pushing and demanding that the legal system protect that right.
I absolutely agree with you. And I know that a lot of women who listen to that now will probably, in a way, shrink a little bit or, you know, fawn or freeze. And because I mean, looking back at my two pregnancies, I'm a tall person. I'm quite self-confident. I'm quite educated. And I was so vulnerable and so just paper thin in my pregnancies. So what would you say to women who are in that really, really vulnerable state during their pregnancy and also birth?
Great point. Very good point. You're totally right. And there's multiple axes of vulnerability, right, that you're talking about. One is just we rely on them for care. So that's just before we even get to the fact, you know, how am I feeling inside my body right now in this encounter? Like, you're vulnerable because you're trying to access healthcare that you and your baby might need to survive this birth. And you're also vulnerable because you're relying on them for information. You know, birth is not taught in sex ed. It's not taught in grade school. Women don't know how babies are born. In cultures where they do, this stuff does not happen, right? In cultures where women grow up watching babies be born, they grow up and birth their babies, you know, and everybody understands how physiology works. In a culture like ours, birth is kind of secret behind a veil, not taught. So by the time women are pregnant, they're in a heavy state of reliance on their providers for information and makes them very vulnerable to lying. You know what I mean? And they're lied to all the time about their options and the relative risks of their options. And then, but then say you actually know the truth because you educated yourself before your birth, and then you're in there. Now you're like in labor, or you're not even in labor. You're in a hospital gown. Like you were saying, like, that is such a state of vulnerability. And like, I agree with you. Even I am a lawyer who does this for a living. And the last time I had to like be hospitalized for a couple of days for something not birth related, I got to be reminded that like when you're lying there in a hospital gown, you're lying down. They're standing around you. They're dressed and they're standing up. You're already in an unequal situation, right? Where you're set up to be like, oh my God, I love you guys so much. Please keep me safe. Please, you know what I mean? Like, it's like that. Like fawn, like you said, when we are being frightened, there's kind of four animalistic kind of responses we can have to that, which is fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. And when you think of a woman in labor, you know, fight, huh? Come on. Flight? Where's she going to go?
To the end of the bed. And then that's the end.
Boom,
that's
boom.
What I tried.
It freeze? Was- You're right. You're right. She tried, if she even has enough mobility on her legs to get herself back, right? Freeze, kind of hard to do when your body's birthing a baby, making this the most likely fawn. You know what I mean? Like that's where women are going to go. And so to survive in the moment, not all, of course, women have different coping mechanisms. So coming back to how, when you anticipate the fact that you're not going to want to fight, you know what I mean? And you're going to be so vulnerable. What can you do? A doula who's willing to protect your rights, not a doula who says it's outside my scope to protect your rights. That's, first of all, it's false. There is no scope for doulas. And that's a doula who doesn't want to protect you. So a doula who's willing to do her job of speaking up when your rights are being violated. But a woman who wants a doula to do that for her has to do the work with her doula before the birth to be very clear that she's going to have her doula's back. She cannot fawn while her doula is protecting her. And so they have to have clarity on that. The doula cannot have to worry about the fact that if she says, doctor, she said no episiotomy, I have not even heard you open your mouth to ask if she's changed her mind. The doula needs to know the woman's not going to be like, oh my God, why are you talking? I'm sorry, doctor, you know. Because then doulas can be really exposed and vulnerable themselves. So a doula that's willing to protect your rights, a partner that's willing to, that is ready to have your back and to not be confused and gaslit when they try to manipulate the partner to bully you. So having a team, and again, you, this is crazy. You shouldn't need this. And yet you absolutely do when you're navigating a system that is not prepared to acknowledge your humanity. Unless you are a very good girl, and then they'll be like, pretend they are.
Yeah. Maybe to finish off this conversation, to circle back to earlier cases that we talked about, you said in the Netherlands, it was not a criminal case, but in the US, there are, is it more likely to have a criminal case against the midwife or a civil case against the midwife?
Well, the thing to remember about the US is that we have 50 legal jurisdictions, you know what I mean? And all of them have different laws on this topic because healthcare is managed at the state level for the most part. You know, there are some federal laws that pertain to healthcare, but mostly, you know, you're mostly the licensure of midwives, for example, is something that is done state by state. So whether a state is likely to use criminal law on a midwife is a product of the whether they're licensed and the status of midwives. But actually, within the United States, it's quite similar to the point I was making about Europe, which is, you know, in Europe, quality of maternal health care can kind of be mapped, and it's kind of mapped according to the nation's commitment to protecting human rights in general and the status of women within that nation. Like, those two things are the formula that determine, you know, how strong midwives are in that system and how reliable or whether the right to informed consent is respected. So within Europe, you get sort of northwest, you're going to have the best maternal health systems. You get more southeast, it gets crappier until you have midwives, you know, in Greece and Malta who can't catch the baby. They have to call the doctor and a 50%+ cesarean section rate, right? So within the United States, you have the same thing. So there's a study, if you're interested, it's called Mapping Integration, and it looks at midwifery around the United States, state by state, to look at, and what they found, they mapped three things, I think. Status of midwives in terms of, are they legal? Can they work in both the home and the hospital setting? Is there any kind of integration of midwifery, or are they treated like criminals? And then average cost per birth, and then outcomes for babies. And what they found was the places where midwifery was the most regulated and integrated, you know, strongest, had the best outcomes at the lowest costs. And the states where midwives, and of course, when you look around the United States, it's similar to Europe, right? So the Pacific Northwest is kind of like our most liberal rights protected, the West Coast in general, right? Like Oregon, Washington, California, those are in a way our liberal-ish states, right? Where rights are relatively protected. You get down to the South, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, midwives are underground criminals, you know, for the most part, and very high rates of, like, you know, preterm birth, stillbirth, NICU admissions, all that kind of stuff. And of course, your rights are like the least secure in those states. You have the most racism in those states, et cetera.
Okay. So do you, like, from your viewpoint as a lawyer, do you see that there is a bias against midwives compared to obstetricians?
Whose bias?
The state.
Of course. Who has money? Who has power? Who are men? You know, and even if most OBs are female at this point, they're still very much operating within the patriarchy. You know, this is a first generation or a second generation. We're going to need some more generations of female obstetricians before obstetrics stops screwing women over.
Yeah. I mean, I have the hypothesis that here, I mean, I'm looking at the German-speaking countries, so Austria, Germany, and also Switzerland, and I've been trying to research cases from the last decades, cases that were brought against doctors when something went wrong in birth, and cases that were brought against midwives. And so far, I could find mostly cases against midwives. There's a few cases where both the midwife and the doctor were tried together because they were the birth team. But even in these cases, I can see that the doctor usually got away with less punishment than the midwife.
And in those cases, the doctor is being punished for affiliation with a midwife or acting like a midwife. So that German case of Dr. Anna Robel, was it? She was a doctor, if I remember correctly, but she was subject to that same kind of like your home birth dogma. You wanted, you cared more about your home birth dogma. You didn't care if the baby died as long as your dogma was protected, like that kind of thing. But again, why is she being criminally prosecuted for acting like a midwife, for not being loyal to a system?
Well, she was actually...
Same with Agnes Guerra.
She was a trained midwife and she was a GP. So she wasn't an obstetrician.
Okay.
And I think that was one of the things that they accused her of, that she, because the law in Germany says at a breech birth, you have to have a doctor present. It doesn't say what kind of doctor, but people assume that it has to be an obstetrician. And she was not an obstetrician. She was just a family doctor.
Because you know that obstetricians are so incredibly skillful when it comes to vaginal breech births that we definitely need one there.
So that was just my kind of like, I think that's an ongoing quest I have because I often get criticized when I say, well, there's a bias against midwives, and people say, oh, give me the data, show me that that's true. And I'm like, it's really hard to find cases in Austria if you're not within the legal system, like if you're not a lawyer or have access to these kind of information. So I just wanted to hear what your thoughts are on that. And your
you could just take one case. Like, can you find a single OB who has been subject to criminal prosecution for supporting a woman's medical decision? That's your data. Can you find a single one? You know what I mean? And then look at the arguments that were made against your midwife. Can you find a single time that those kinds of arguments have been made against a doctor? And of course, the nature of the arguments is biased against midwives by saying you're part of what we have a problem with here is that you didn't let the provider that we prefer do the birth.
Yeah, that is powerful and sad at the same time.
Agreed.
Yes. We're coming towards the end of our time. Anything else that you would like to add to this conversation?
I mean, I guess that collective advocacy is powerful. And at the same time, individuals can stand up for the rights of others, right? You know, I think in all nations, like, these issues of women's rights and childbirth are not on the mainstream radar for most women. And that's, of course, like I said at the beginning, part of why I do this work is feeling like this is an issue that needs solving and nobody's solved. But, you know, what you can remember is that other times when women have fought for their rights to vote, to own property, to have rights to their children, to work, at the time that any women were fighting for those things, the vast majority of women didn't care or weren't joining them in the fight. But once that door was opened by those who were willing to push for those rights, other women were happy to flood through the door, you know. So just to take heart, and the truth is on your side, that medical evidence is on your side. Bioethics is on your side.
Wow. Thank you. These are very powerful last words for this conversation. For the listeners who want to find you, get in touch with you, where can you be reached?
I have a website, Hermine Hayes Klein. It's HayesKleinLaw.com, and you can reach me through the contact form there. I also am on Instagram and Facebook.
All right. I'll put all of that in the show notes, and I will let you get back to your very important work now. Thank you very much.
Aww, it was such a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for listening. This was my conversation with Hermine Hayes Klein. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. You can also subscribe to the podcast. As I mentioned in the intro, most of my episodes are in German, but once in a while, I have amazing English-speaking guests on. Coming up, I have Dr. Koen Derlo from the Netherlands, who is a pioneer for the mother-assisted cesarean. And later in the summer, I will have Jen Kamel, the founder of VBAC Facts, on the podcast. So please subscribe, share, like, all the things. Thank you very much.